some local people that campaigned against building on metropolitan open land got together and had an open meeting to discuss what positive transformation could be co-designed for this plot of land. And the main ideas that came out were a swimming space. So could we turn the old filter bed structures into swimming spaces? There is a need for free nature-based swimming. People are swimming in a polluted river because they want free access to swimming in nature.
Hi, I'm Robin, and this is Beneath the City is Soil, a journey into the future of today, a collection of conversations with humans engaged in world-building projects. Rehearsals of human and ecological flourishing emerging from the decomposing matter of a late capitalist system that has set our world on fire. Part 3, Infrastructure of Our Own. This episode takes us across London from east to west. First, I headed to the Lea River in East London to meet one of the directors of the East London Waterworks Park, Nathan Miller, to visit the site of the proposed brownfield rainforest, natural swimming ponds, forest school and community hub. Later in the episode, we'll meet Leslie Barson of Granville Community Kitchen and Farm in South Kilburn, who is working to build a local agroecological food system for the South Kilburn community. But first, let's join Nathan on the Lea Bridge, just over from the lush and green fringes of East London's marshes.
So I'm Nathan. I'm one of five directors at East London Waterworks Park, and amongst 650 volunteers. We're an environmental charity aiming to buy the site owned by central government, former Thames Water Depot, and turn it into a new park for ecological habitats, natural swimming ponds, community spaces geared towards connecting people with nature.
The proposed East London Waterworks Park is located on a brownfield site that was formerly a Thames Water Depot. While it currently sits carpeted in concrete, the communities surrounding it have reimagined the space as a rewilded biodiverse park.
There are four sets of filter beds here that were, for 150 years, delivering drinking water to about a million homes in North East London. Three quarters of those filter beds have been turned into nature reserves in the 1960s, and this final plot, which is still pretty huge, it's like 10 football pitches big, it's 5.68 hectares, was left when the rest of it was turned into nature reserves. And then in the 80s, they decided to put a layer of concrete on top of the site, and it sat as a storage depot from the early 80s to now. Metal fences went up and sort of disconnected from Leighton Marshes and Hackney Marshes and the surrounding nature reserves. But underneath, there is the filter bed structures are still there, so 5 or 6 metres deep of empty sort of hollow space, which in the other spaces has been, you know, turned into nature reserves. The site was bought by the Department for Education, or rather an arm's length property management company for the Department for Education, who at the time were buying up plots of land to build schools on. The land is metropolitan open land, which is greenbelt in London. It has very specific protections to protect development. It's surrounded by nature reserves and marshes. It's at huge risk of flood. We're standing right by the River Lea, which is, you know, one of the biggest suppliers to the River Thames. And it's flood zones 2 and 3, this site. So, you know, the highest risk of flood. And so building schools on that space is maybe not too advisable. Mm. They had a planning permission rejected in 2019 when some local people that campaigned against building on metropolitan open land got together at the pub next door to the site, the one that we're standing outside of, and had an open meeting to discuss what positive transformation could be co-designed for this plot of land. And the main ideas that came out were a swimming space. So could we turn the old filter bed structures into swimming spaces? There is a need for free nature-based swimming. People are swimming in a polluted river because they want free access to swimming in nature. And then could we reconnect this space with the surrounding nature reserves, create ecological habitats that local flora and fauna would be attracted to, and renature the space that is currently concrete? Can we create learning activities for people to reconnect with nature as being a primary aspect of what we're doing, using the buildings as sustainable hubs? And then could this be community owned and managed, designing it in a way that is led by the community? We had a fundraiser, a crowdfunder, in 2022-2023. I joined the project in order to kickstart that. I live locally and wanted my kids to grow up with this kind of space that they could be involved in co-creating.
A really unique aspect to the East London Waterworks Park is their organisational structure and use of co-design methods to collectively decide what is built into the Waterworks Park design. Co-design is a participatory approach to designing solutions, where community members are treated as equal collaborators in the design process. I asked Nathan if he could explain this further.
We have six different working groups, so there's 650 volunteers. There are six different areas. Anyone can join and be part of it. You don't have to have a background in any aspect, and we get lots of people changing career through being involved. People who have joined as urban planners and are now being trained as family social workers through joining the design circle and then becoming involved in the inclusivity circle work. The six different working groups are the design circle. So we have lots of architects. We also have experienced ecologists and landscape gardeners and landscape architects. This being an opportunity to bring people together in ecology and architecture and engineering, and for people to learn in that process and to co-design a community space. Fundraising Circle, which raises funds for all the co-design activities, led the crowdfunder. The Communication Circle has lots of web developers, user experience designers, web designers, lots of artists and illustrators, social media and content producers. The Inclusivity Circle, which focuses on listening to people from backgrounds that have been strategically and historically underrepresented in urban environmental projects, working with other charities that support 22 different demographics, people recovering from homelessness, people recovering from mental health crises, wide range of different ethnicity and class and religious backgrounds, all with the hope to create community agency in the kinds of design spaces that have, you know, previously been ignored in many ways. And so we have a lot of community researchers in the Inclusivity Circle. The Learning Circle, which does a lot of what the design and the Inclusivity Circle do, but with schools, vocational colleges, as we'll talk about, and universities as well, so a broad range of learning experiences created. And then the Governance Circle work with charity administration, business models, community infrastructure, and how we design this whole thing. We make decisions by consent rather than consensus, so we're a sociocratic organisation, which means that not everyone has to fully, completely agree on an idea being proposed, and that anyone can bring an idea forward. But consent means that you're okay, you can live with the idea, and it means that we can operate in a community-led way, which is quite nimble and agile, but also it builds buy-in from the bottom up as well.
So what design did the communities that surround the site decide on when drawing up the final plans for East London Waterworks Park? Nathan and I walked around the site while he explained the vision for the rewilded area.
But where we're standing now is where we hope to create about 15,000 square metres of ecological habitats, what we call the dry petals. So each of the 5,000 square metre radiating petals out from the centre of the site has a different ecological habitat that our ecologists and landscape gardeners have designed in the dry habitats proposal. Which the one we're closest to now is what we call the orange petal. And we will use some of the concrete that we take up for the swimming ponds. We're not going to take up the concrete across the whole of the site because it would be financially and environmentally expensive. We don't really want to take concrete off-site. We don't want to dig up all the concrete. So we want to try and reuse concrete as much as possible. And something I've learned from our ecologists is that concrete can be crushed up and used as aggregate for growing wildflower meadows. And we will aim to provide pollinator habitats of about 5,000 square metres in this specific space, using crushed up concrete as the growing medium for pollinator habitats, wildflower meadows, as a way to lower the financial and environmental cost, and that builds into the circular economy of the site as well. If we're not transporting this concrete that we dig up for the swimming ponds off-site, it's much less carbon intensive. It ties into this idea of the brownfield rainforest that Natural England came up with. They coined the idea around Canvey Wick Nature Reserve, a space which is former sort of, I think it was going to be an oil drilling area, but it was not developed and left to turn into nature, and now it's become a specific site of scientific interest because there are so many rare bugs and reptiles and mammals and all kinds of different species have made their home in spaces that were not made for them, but in how resilient nature is. There's an aspect of what we're trying to do is to work with the land rather than disrupting it. We're trying to work with the existing situation and co-create through inclusivity, through local communities, but also with nature. In our co-design workshops, we use animal personas and ecosystem personas quite a lot, as we'll talk about in a moment, to support the idea generation around these different sites. So the second petal, which is a bit further that way, is the green petal, and where the orange petal will be 5,000 square meters of wildflower meadows. Specifically, this will be mounds and ditches, and what our ecologists have introduced me to is called hibernacula. So big mounds that different kinds of invertebrates can create their habitats in and can hibernate in, and that sort of mound and ditch aspect, you know, from the reused concrete, will also create sustainable drainage systems which will filter through to the natural swimming ponds. The third area is a lot more experimental. We've had a lot of interest about remediation, so how do we turn industrial sites into green spaces? And the brown petal, again 5,000 square meters, will be dedicated to letting nature lead and how do we remediate spaces using water, using fungi, using different kinds of plants. So phytoremediation is all about remediation of contamination using water, mycelial remediation using fungi and mushrooms, and yet other kinds of bioremediation using bull reeds and sunflowers, and our ecologists have been leading ideas around how we turn brownfield sites into green spaces, and we've had a lot of interest from universities about how we do this and it being a site of specific research for that. So each of these ideas, the dry habitats, the wetlands ecology, the forest school, the swimming ponds, the circular economy of the site, the buildings, each of the design proposals take inspiration from what the inclusivity circle does. So as I mentioned before, the inclusivity circle listens to people from backgrounds, 22 different backgrounds that have been historically and strategically underrepresented in urban environmental projects. And we spend a long period of time listening to hundreds of people from these different 22 backgrounds about their barriers to participation in those kinds of activities. And we build those hopes and dreams into the design of the park. So when we've been listening to people from different backgrounds and, you know, we sort of started with a lot of reading around the subject, how people interact with nature in Hackney based on their cultural background. My mum's family are from Jamaican heritage, and did a workshop with Hackney Caribbean Elderly Association and at the mosque at the end of my road, and the different interactions with nature and whether nature is accessed as a wild space and whether people are receptive to that, or whether nature should be more contained and manicured in specific gardens. I think there's different participatory preferences for how different kinds of people want to interact. And as we go through this process, we listen to people, we listen to their barriers to participation. A lot of the stuff was about food, which we were quite cautious about, saying, yes, we can definitely grow food on contaminated land. So we thought about this for a long time, and I was on the phone to a newly joined volunteer of ours, Julia, who co-founded a space in Canning Town called Cody Docks, and she was training to be an ethnobotanist. And I was like, what is ethnobotany? She said, it's the study of people and plants and the cultural relationships between people and plants, and could we expand food growing into ethnobotany? So thinking about how different plants might be grown across the site. For example, in the forest school, can we grow cordage for rope bridges and swings? Can we grow things for den making? How can we support plants in a sort of a biophilic sense of their own life and expansion, and not just have an extractive policy? So thinking about it in a sort of a broader context, we realised that we wanted to speak about and engage with food growing in that kind of way. And so ethnobotany was an approach that encompassed our inclusivity policy of nature in our heart, but also engaged with the nature learning and nature connection aspects of what we're intending to do. And so the design circle now have an ethnobotany proposal, and we've run co-design workshops in ethnobotany. And the volunteers that have led that are anthropologists who, on top of that, are architects and inclusivity researchers. The more conversations that we begin to have, the more communal knowledge that we begin to build, and people begin to sort of feed into that, which I think is really powerful. Yeah, this is the area of the site where we initially put the forest school, 2,000 square metres of particular learning space, initially for young people, but we wanted to be intergenerational. Nature connection activities around storytelling, cooking, herb growing and gardening, den making, through our inclusivity listening processes, which include a variety of young people from different backgrounds, special education needs and disabilities, parents with young children, who we've now expanded that design from more than one forest school space, I think to three or four different spaces on the site, which will encompass about 15,000 square metres of learning space specifically, which is twice the amount that Hampstead Heath nature education space has. We are intending on creating 3,000 square metres of swimming ponds and 5,000 square metres of reed bed filtration, so about 8,000 square metres of wetlands area in total, and about 1,600 square metres of beach to relax near that space, with the cleaning capacities of the reed beds, because the water would be cleaned via reed beds and aquatic plants rather than chlorine. We are intending on bringing together the water for that through a rainwater harvesting system across the site, not using the river, which is heavily polluted, but channeling water into the ponds, cleaning it, and then potentially putting some back into the river. And reed beds are very good at cleaning the water, taking out heavy metals and other contaminants like nitrogen and other pollutants which currently pollute the water. Filter beds that exist under the site are what we hope to use as natural swimming ponds. We want to dig up the concrete that's being layered on top to reveal the filter beds that could be used as the natural swimming pond spaces. What we do with that concrete is a question, an environmental or financial question, and so the ecologists have come up with ideas to use that concrete on site. We want to crush up the concrete in one particular space and use it as aggregate for growing wildflower meadows. Concrete as a space for nature to create habitats has been found to be really good in areas like Canby Wick, which has been noted as a brownfield rainforest by Natural England, which is a space that a variety of very rare species have moved their habitats into. So there's more we can do in urban settings for reusing these kinds of materials on site to create more habitats for invertebrates, small mammals, amphibians, and in the orange petal in particular, 5,000 square metres of it, pollinator habitats and wildflower meadows. In the next 5,000 square metres, mounds and ditches, so hibernacular specific mounds for, I think there are digger bees and different kinds of invertebrates that create their habitats in sort of crushed concrete mounds like this, but also for water birds in the local area and small mammals like water voles and other amphibians and reptiles as well. The other aspect is around research and how we turn brownfield sites into green spaces using natural remediation processes. So our ecologists have come up with a variety of processes using natural remediation, from phytoremediation, which is all about how we turn contaminated spaces into safe green spaces using water, mycelial remediation, which is all about fungi and mushrooms and remediating spaces, and then other forms of bioremediation using bull reeds and sunflowers and other kinds of plants.
The plans for East London Waterworks Park sound really fantastic. The summers in London only continue to get hotter. Accessible, cool and green spaces such as these will become vital. But despite all of the organisation's campaigning work and planning, Nathan and others have not yet had the green light to get started.
In late 2023, we were very close to getting a meeting with the Secretary of State for Education, who was the key decision maker. And for a variety of reasons, that didn't happen. And then we heard later that year that there was going to be a planning application for a secure facility for children on the site. So we heard about that in December 2023, and that was going to be put in August 2024. And up until that point, we had had positive feedback about fundraising and meeting and our proposals in general. And then it went very quiet, and then we heard about this proposal for a secure facility. So throughout 2024, the charity put together a propositional rather than oppositional campaign towards the secure facility for children. And the design circle, in fact, probably at this table quite often, published and did co-design workshops around the swimming ponds, circular economy, the buildings and community spaces we want to create on site. As of August 2024, that planning application was delayed indefinitely. We have heard that Waltham Forest Council are going to be involved in the delivery process. We have in principle support from Waltham Forest Council as well. And in the process, we have been working on some other projects, for example, with Waltham Forest College and Newham College, vocational colleges in Waltham Forest and Newham, around co-design activities, co-creation activities of green and blue, so sustainable drainage spaces. Waltham Forest College suffered, I think, about 10 grand's worth of flood damage in 2021. And so how can we support the plumbing and engineering students to co-create green spaces which have flood resilience built into them? That, I think, supports green skills development from young people, thinking about public health and water and developing spaces, developing that sense of community agency that they can change the spaces around them.
If you want to see East London Waterworks Park become a reality, you can volunteer your time with them or email Waltham Forest councillors to support the campaign. Just search East London Waterworks Park for more information. From a brownfield rainforest in East London, we're travelling to the bustling South Kilburn in West London to meet Leslie Barson, co-founder of Granville Community Kitchen and Granville Community Farm Hub, to hear about how they're building a local agroecological food system from the ground up.
I'm Leslie, and I'm one of the co-founders and co-coordinators of Granville Community Kitchen, along with my dear old friend, Deirdre Woods. And we met many years ago. We both came out of a small educational project called the Otherwise Club. And that was about organising around alternative education. South Kilburn became a New Deal for Communities area, which was a flagship project of Blair's government. So it was giving 50 million from central government, 50 million match funded from private funding to areas that were considered of desperate need. And I think there were 8 in London, and South Kilburn was one of them. It was an absolute disaster. It wasn't always a disaster, but in South Kilburn, it was a complete disaster, more than a disaster, because what happened was all the community leaders were drawn into it, which was seemed good at first. There was lots of money spent. There was away days like you've never seen. I mean, coaches would drive up and people would get on and get off, and there were lunches. And yeah. But I would argue, and quite coherently that there is not one thing to show for that £100 million after 10, 20 years. So Dee and I were watching all this happening, as well as there's a wonderful woman called Merle, who ran a cafe at the Granville in the sort of 80s, 90s, get this fabulous plate of Caribbean food piled high for £3, I remember, and Sky Juice, which all the kids loved. But she retired in 2009, so the kitchen was empty. And in 2013, the council decreed that there should be no rentals of the hall. It has a beautiful, beautiful hall, the Granville, and this hall paid for the building. So births, deaths, marriages, big birthdays, whatever, yeah. And it was hired out Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and it brought in enough money to support the building. And once the council said that couldn't be used anymore, we realised this is the death of the building, because then they say it's not profitable. I mean, it's not. And it's just nobody's using it, which they did. So Dee is a fabulous cook and actually won BBC Cook of the Year 2016. And so we set up Granville Community Kitchen in 2014 to take over the kitchen that Merle had left. Not as a catering, it was more about community and about food and reaching community through food. We did lunches for the people who were in the building, but they were staffed by disabled adults, so they would get catering training, they would get front of house training. We had lots of work experience for young people. We had a food grower. We were doing film nights and salsa dancing classes, but all with food and so on. And the most popular thing we did was a community meal, which was just free and halal and just come and meet your neighbour. And it was a much better way to deal with the economic problems of food, but also all the social and cultural problems. So, you know, meeting your neighbour and playing dominoes or letting off steam or bringing a letter that you've just received that's frightened you out of your wits. All these things, you know, it just became a real what you want a community to be. And through that, we were giving away some surplus food as well. And then when COVID came, the people who cooked for the community meal disappeared. So the kitchen had to close, but we were handing out food. And then we turned around, I don't know, a month in, and we were the only ones there. So we started to serve a huge area of London through COVID, up to almost Watford and East Finchley and Lewisham we were going down. So we had lots of drivers who would go out. We had huge supplies of surplus food, which you'd divide up. We had loads of volunteers, people giving us money, and, you know, it was fantastic. Then gradually, the volunteers start disappearing. The numbers of people wanting food, so we did twice a week, we would do food. From City Harvest, mostly. People on the high road would bring us stuff. Also, people in the area who knew about us would pick stuff up from, oh, their bakery was giving away a lot. But the problem was, the need was so huge, and we felt all we're doing actually is putting ourselves between people and the government and stopping the government from getting the, you know, yelled at, you know, because we're taking up the flak. And we were also, a lot of what we were doing was adult social service work. And we hoped that as the adult social services came back, that a lot of that work would be taken away. And we didn't just want to do surplus food aid because it's creating dependency. It's not actually solving anything. We were feeding 1,500 people a week, I would say. Obviously, as COVID opened up things again, we couldn't serve such a wide area because it was traffic and we didn't have volunteers. So we started to pull in the area to certain local postcodes. So we went to an emergency food aid only program. So that's people with no recourse to public funds, people who are housebound due to physical or mental illness, and people fleeing domestic violence. And we hoped that that would die away because all the social services and the various services would come back and take it up. Unfortunately, it has not been the case, and we've trebled to quadrupled those numbers, original numbers, and we're getting referrals, and we deliver all the food. But, you know, we're getting referrals from adult social services and CAB and job centres and GP's offices and hospitals. But it's just a sign of the desperate, bad situation we are in. We're not a charity, we're a co-op, and we work in solidarity with people. So, you know, any one of us could be needing food at any minute. You know, we're not far away from being in the situation.
Granville Community Kitchen is working towards a world in which everyone has access to nutritious, sustainable, and culturally rooted food, and where communities are resilient to future economic and climactic shocks. I asked Leslie where her interest in food justice and growing began, and how Granville Community Kitchen lives out its values through its organisational structure.
Yes, so I've always been a sort of amateur grower and loved it, but not had it in the idea that I could do it, because it felt a very sort of far away thing. I'm a very urban dweller. In 2012, in the garden in Granville that was outside, had this huge garden, Dee started digging up all the weeds. We just all helped because it was a home ed group, so lots of kids, and we're all pulling up this stuff and everything. And it was fabulous, and we started planting stuff there, and it was wonderful. And we just all got involved, and, you know, well, how can we grow a tomato? Oh, you need a windowsill, and, you know, I don't know, you're just looking online or looking in books and figuring it all out. Yeah, so it's... But obviously we wanted the organisation to match the political ideals of the world that we're hoping to model. I mean, one thing, we've just done a big conference on radical HR, which is really interesting. So looking at our pay policy, so we are our equality pay policy, everybody gets the same, but there is quite a move to do an equity pay policy. So if, for example, if you have children, you might get a bit more. If you have caring needs, you might get a bit more. If you have inherited wealth coming to you, you might get a bit less. So all these things, and we're just thinking about whether to move to that kind of policy. Dee and I had been in another group called London Community Neighbourhood Cooperative, which was quite an ambitious project to try and build in North Westminster a eco-housing development for the future. So it was a vision of how we could live more sustainably, and it was a co-op, it had a housing co-op involved, so we'd done lots and lots of work with the Co-ops UK. So we knew about BenComs, which is what we are, a society for the benefit of the community. Workers' co-ops are great. If you've got a little business and you want, that's fine, but if you're doing something like we are, where we want the community to have some say or some input, it is really tricky in a normal co-op. So BenComs are great.
Granville Community Kitchen hosts a programme called the Good Food Box in response to a broken industrial food system. It provides low-cost organic fruit and veg to the West London community, while also ensuring a fair wage to the land workers that produce it. I asked Leslie to explain how it works.
In South Kilburn we do Food Aid, the weekly organic veg box called the Good Food Box. And the idea with this was, it is a business, but the model has a three-tiered pricing scheme. So the lower price was that people in South Kilburn who were on much lower incomes or UC or not would be able to have access to good food. So at the lower level, I think it's six items of organic food is £4.25 and £12.40 at the higher. So the idea is that the people at the higher tier are paying a little bit extra, so they're investing in their neighbour. Those people do not want to... to join the Good Food Box. And I think a lot of people see the sort of climate change answer as, you know, having everything they want, but just like doing it slightly better. And the shift from there to actually, we can't, we have to have a lot less, and we can't have everything we want. We really have to change how we view our lives and how our relationship to stuff, including food. So the Good Food Box is a really great, in principle, project. But it is basically, at the moment, what we see it as is sustainable food aid, because we're having to fund it with grants and donations and things so that people on the lower tiers are able to have these bags. And this veg in these bags is sustainable. I mean, it's good for the earth, good for the grower, they're getting well paid, and good for the eater. Everybody knows, you know, when you've got potatoes, tomatoes, whatever in your bag, you know what farm they've come from and who the farmer is, and then we can do little... My mouth drops open, the fact that food is considered not a human right. And the fact prices of food are set by bureaucrats in Chicago and New York. It's crazy. Where do we wind up with this system? So it's such an injustice and so basic to being a human. If the supermarkets paid the real price for the damage they're doing, then organic and other and agroecological food would have a chance. But now, good food, in inverted commas, is so expensive. When you go to them, you buy, you know, whatever from the supermarket, you are not paying the real price for that food. And largely what you're paying is profits for that company. I often think about where we can intercept to make the most difference. And I think that supermarkets should be paying for the soil You know, if they're going to use all those chemicals, they should be, there should be some climate tax so that they have to pay, as well as paying farmers a decent wage and not driving down the price and so on. They have too much monopoly over the food. I think, you know, councils should only be planting fruit and nut trees now. They should be managers who harvest them with the community and so on, and share it out. And we have a great load of people in the area called the Kensalter Kilburn Harvesters. And people call them up and say, my tree's full, come and take it. And they bring a load of it to our food aid. So they take it to hospitals or to schools who cook with this stuff. I think food growing is a really easy way to get in touch with the land and to see the seasons and to see the cycle of it. Much easier than...
Across all of Granville Community Kitchen's food and growing programmes, they adopt an agroecological approach. Agroecology is an umbrella term to mean organic and biodynamic farming, agroforestry and permaculture. Sustainable farming methods that apply both ecological, the relationship between plants, animals, humans and the environment, and social principles, meaning the protection of land worker livelihoods. In practice, it involves food production that coexists with and protects the natural environment.
Agroecology is good for the land, for the worker, but it also brings in not just the health of the eater, but the justice for all of us. Forest gardens, and you don't need to grow in rows, you don't need to dig and hurt the soil. Part of the vision that Dee and I have always had is that we would have, as was done up until the 50s in Paris, there is a ring around the city of market gardens, and they fed the city. All the animal manure went out onto the gardens. It was an absolutely great sort of symbiotic relationship and worked really well, solved all sorts of problems. But gradually, partly as the land became more expensive, farmers sold it to, you know, make money, and partly because of the huge pressure from companies to buy food overseas, which gave them more money, that has disappeared. And in fact, about 88 acres in the Lee Valley that was growing lettuce, and it was all under glass, and it was sold because they couldn't make enough money to make it work anymore. There was lots of...
Inspired by past city food systems, and as the cost of living crisis only deepens, and with it the price of good and healthy foods, Granville Community Kitchen is building a local agroecological food system based in Stevenage that will connect residents of South Kilburn and Stevenage to build a food system and recreational and educational hub that ensures access to low-cost organic foods.
We've just signed a sort of partnership agreement for a 30-acre site, mostly field, but a bit of forest as well. And we're starting to plan. That's what these are. This is the field and the forest at the top. And we're planning, you know, what we need this year, and then we probably won't be growing until next year. It's quite a big, ambitious project, but it's really exciting. And I think one of the things that's most exciting for me is this idea of how to relink the city and the country. And so this is a South Kilburn farm, but what are we doing to make it a South Kilburn farm? We're hoping quite soon to have a minibus that will go out every day and take people out both ways and take veg out both ways. I think where we're coming to is about belonging, so that people from South Kilburn go out there and they know what to do and they know how it goes and they know who to ask and feel comfortable and part of it. And people from Weston and this area, Stevenage area, can come to South Kilburn and know who to, you know, whose door to knock on and where to go and so on and what to join. But we're also hoping that people will feel they've had a part in building it. And we took our first group out in September. One chap was caught on camera. I didn't hear him. He was saying, "This is our land. We're never going to leave." We thought, wow, this is so important to people, to have some connection with the land. And I think people who come from other places which have lost their connection with the land more recently than we have, and we're many generations away from it, but there are other places in the world where they've only recently left the land, and they would feel more connected and more needing of that connection And you see how important it is for people. We had two big grants from Reaching Communities and Esme Fairbairn, who've been fantastic funding the dedicated staff to work on it because it's such a big project, which has been great, and we couldn't have done it without them. And they're also hoping to fund us further on now that we've got the project going. Our vision for it is that it's the sort of backyard or the garden of a very urban place, so people feel a part of it and can go out there. And we hope that people will come for all sorts of reasons, you know, so they may come for a picnic and just to mess about for a day or an hour or whatever. And then on the other hand, you might have people coming to do very formal training courses, agroecological courses on it, and everything in between. This isn't the only ecological or food system or agroecological food system that's possible, but it's a good one and it's a good model, and it can teach and show a lot of other people to build better now. Yeah. And if we can actually do it, so can others, and they can do it, they'll do it better or different or whatever. That'd be fantastic.
While the Granville Community Farm Hub is still at its early stages, the Granville Rec, home to Granville Community Kitchen's current community garden and growing project, is under threat for demolition to make way for a private housing development. I spoke to Leslie to understand why the site is at risk and what we can do about it.
So the Granville and the Carlton are these two big old buildings, Victorian buildings, in the middle of the estate, really. And the Granville had this huge growing space in front of it, and we took it over and grew loads of stuff there. They then decided to tear down most of the Granville and to build a new community centre on the site of our garden, in front of the Granville. So we have been fighting that since 2016, and there is a bit of the Granville left. The community is being offered, but it's structurally been damaged by the fact that they've taken away two-thirds of the building. So we need the council to fix the structure before we would take it on. But potentially that's a small health and wellbeing centre we're hoping to make that. So we're in this old park that had been locked up. They'd built on other areas on Granville Road and made this park in order to pay the community back for building on those other areas, and then locked it about a year after it was opened because there was no money for management. So we have brought it back into use, and if you go to our website, there's a little film showing some of the before and after pictures, and all sorts of fabulous things happened there this year. And we had four or five schools in, we've had 12 people get their level one horticulture, city and guilds, people doing introduction to growing, all kinds of education. It's just been amazing, and it looks so beautiful. And Brent Council want to build 14 homes on it. And we are now saying this is crazy. And they are going out for a single developer now. And there's three developers who are interviewing at the moment. And one of them have told me that they would not build on the site, which is fantastic. Fingers crossed. But we need to put pressure on the council at the moment and on these developers. They need to hear that this is an issue.
You can find an email template and sign a petition to save the Granville Rec over on Granville Community Kitchen's website. Next week will be something a little different. We'll hear a folk tale told by Forest School practitioner, trainer and storyteller Richard Skrine. Thank you for listening. Beneath the City of Soil was created and produced by me, Robin Moffat, with the support of Transmission Roundhouse.